It's Wednesday, February the 2nd, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Even as thousands filled the streets of Cairo and other Egyptian cities, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak announced that he would not seek re-election in September when his term comes to an end. His 30-year autocratic rule will end, he said, just months away. And yet, the crowds on the streets of Alexandria, Cairo, and other Egyptian cities do not seem interested in focusing on September, but rather on the days ahead. Here is what has been noted by many international observers. Almost every day, the Mubarak regime has given up something. Some major concession has been made that has appeased the crowd on the streets. But this very process of appeasement also fuels the demand for further concessions. And in this case, it appears that the removal of Hosni Mubarak from office, not in September, but now, appears to be the goal of these crowds. Anthony Shadid, reporting in the New York Times, indicates that the big question hanging over this particular revolutionary development is where this entire thing is going. As he reports, there is no clear leadership, and because of the autocratic nature of the Mubarak regime, there is no legitimate opposition. Mr. Shadid writes, quoting Ghassan Abdel Razek, a human rights activist in Egypt, "This is what worries me. Where does this go? How do you create a leadership that can represent these people without dividing them?" Well, that is a pressing question. It's often the most pressing question that follows some kind of revolution. It was certainly the case in the French Revolution in the late 18th century and into the early 19th century. But it is clearly also the case in Egypt, where the mobs on the streets want change, but it is not yet clear what kind of change they want. "We don't want what we have," said one young protester in Tahrir Square, perhaps articulating on behalf of thousands or even millions of others the situation of change mania that has reached the streets of Egypt. "We want what we don't have. We don't want what we have." Selma Arterizi, a 33-year-old film director, said, "For the first time, people feel like they belong to this place. At this point, a good deal of the euphoria seems to be finding its voice just in the fact that there is a crowd that is demanding change." How should the United States respond? This is a very difficult question, but at this point it appears that the response of the Obama administration has not gone over well in Egypt. Writing about this, Nicholas Kristof, a columnist for the New York Times with whom I am often in rather radical disagreement, wrote something that I did find very thoughtful. He writes about being in Tahrir Square, formerly known as Liberation Square. He wrote of living in Cairo years ago when the square evoked a menacing kind of mood, but now he says the manic drivers are gone, replaced by cheering throngs waving banners clamoring for democracy they never got, and by volunteers who scrupulously pick up litter, establish order, and hand out drinks and food. It appears that Mr. Kristof is trying to make the point that this is not just an unruly crowd. He writes, continuing, "In short, Tahrir Square has lost its menace and suddenly become the most exhilarating place in the world." He said one question does nag him, and that is, why do these crowds believe that the United States is solidly behind the Mubarak regime? Mr. Kristof is quite an expert on international relations, and as I said, I'm often in very clear disagreement with him. But on one point made in his column, he makes a great deal of sense, and that is that the United States has absolutely nothing to gain by being recognized as being on the wrong side of democracy, which is supposed to be what our own national convictions are all about. We'll be watching this situation, but in the meantime, there's some other things to keep in mind. Gerald Seib, who's one of the most insightful commentators on these things for the Wall Street Journal, suggests that we consider the last 6 decades of Middle Eastern history by dividing them into 3 phases. The first began, no coincidence, in Egypt, when Gamal Abdel Nasser led a revolution in that land in 1952. He suggests that the second phase came with the Arab world's humiliation in the 1967 war with Israel, and the third with the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. It's easy to see how all 3 of these events produced phases that shaped the entire Arab world. But now, he says, we're likely entering a 4th phase, but no one knows what this phase is going to look like. He concludes his article by saying, And in this, he's quoting Mohammed Haikal, a Nasser confidant, that is, a confidant of the first Egyptian strongman from 1952, Nasser, who said this, and this was said, by the way, 3 years ago. The effect of mobiles, that is, mobile phones, computers, satellites, there is a generation coming that is outside the traditional controls. Normally, generations recreate themselves, but something else is happening, end quote. That was a prophetic word, because what's happening on the streets of Egypt is being fueled by a generation that is communicating by these cell phones and digital technologies and the internet. It is a generation, to use his very poignant words, outside the traditional controls. The trembling and tottering Mubarak regime can bear firsthand testimony to that. With the Super Bowl coming this weekend, you might think that Texas law enforcement officials are getting ready for a major crowd control challenge. And of course they are. But there's something more ominous going on in terms of the preparations being made by law enforcement officials, especially federal officials there in Texas. Their concern is sex trafficking, and in particular, the sex trafficking of underage children and especially underage girls. Michelle Goldberg, reporting for Newsweek magazine, writes this. While football fans are eagerly anticipating the February 6th Super Bowl showdown in Dallas, some state officials are gearing up for the big game's dark side, the surge in human trafficking that tends to accompany major sports and entertainment events. Ernie Allen, president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, said, quote, what we've learned is that sexual trafficking, sexual exploitation of children in particular, is all about supply and demand, end quote. Federal authorities indicate that law enforcement officials in Texas are doing an unusually good job in getting ready to address the issue of sex trafficking with relation to the Super Bowl. In the 2009 Super Bowl held in Tampa, Florida's Department of Children and Families took in 24 children who'd been trafficked into that city for sex work over the Super Bowl weekend. Texas, second only to California when it comes to sex trafficking, is concerned that the situation in Dallas could be much worse. One reason for this is the over 1,000-mile border with Mexico, which allows the trafficking of international sex slaves across the border in a way that might not be possible in other areas. Rick Jervis, reporting for USA Today, goes over much of the same terrain, but in this case, he quotes Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, who said, the Super Bowl was the greatest show on earth. But it also has an ugly underbelly. It's commonly known as the single largest human trafficking incident in the United States. Here are some stats that you ought to keep in mind as you consider the scale of this problem. And I'll admit to you that until I saw these stats myself, I had no idea the problem is on this scale in the United States as related to just one big weekend known as the Super Bowl. Each year, 100,000 to 300,000 American kids, some as young as 12 years of age, are exploited in the sex trade. The traffickers use the Super Bowl and other large events to ply their trade, and that is according to the report by Rick Jervis in USA Today. The sex traffickers pinpoint the Super Bowl as a premium opportunity to sell the sexual services of young girls. Here are a couple of other facts to keep in mind. Last year, two Florida men were convicted on federal charges for using the Craigslist website to subject a 14-year-old girl to prostitution. During last year's Super Bowl in Miami, child advocates discovered that at least 16 out-of-town underage prostitutes were working the streets and hotels of South Beach. One Hawaii man was recently convicted of flying in a 17-year-old girl for a South Beach hotel for prostitution during last year's Super Bowl. This story goes on and on, as does the account of the horror of child sex trafficking in America. It's very easy just to put it out of sight and out of mind and believe that it doesn't happen, but it does. And even as we witness the Super Bowl weekend with all of its sports festivities this weekend, keep in mind that for at least some children, it is the prime opportunity for their exploitation. I found these news accounts to be particularly troubling. When the law of supply and demand is invoked in this horrible situation, it reminds us of just how sinful humanity is, of the depths to which human beings will sin and will use others in that sin, in the exploitation, in this case, of underage girls. One of the most horrifying things one could imagine is for human beings to subject each other to this kind of horrible sexual exploitation. It tells us even more about ourselves that a major sporting event like the Super Bowl becomes a focus for strategic deployment by the human traffickers. We've been following the controversies about MTV's sexually explicit program about adolescents known as Skins. It is now known that Monday's episode, the third in the series, saw the ratings slip from 3.3 million to 1.6 million. More significantly, six major advertisers have withdrawn their support of the program. These include General Motors, the William Wrigley Jr. division of Mars, the Taco Bell division of Young Brands, H&R Block, the Schick division of Energizer Holdings, and Subway Restaurants. MTV continues to defend the program. Now get this, you just need to hear these words and consider what this MTV official is actually saying. Brian Easley, the co-creator of Skins, said in the Los Angeles Times that Skins, quote, is the opposite of pornography, end quote. Now here's the line. It isn't us who are being provocative, he said. I think that some of the people who object to the show are being provocative in the use of that word, end quote. That word, of course, is pornography. And this is a prime example of Orwellian doublespeak, when the man who's producing pornography suggests that what's really salacious is the fact that his show is being called pornography by those who are concerned. Now, when you think about cultural and moral change, keep this in mind. Skins has featured both advertising and a storyline related to pregnancy and a pregnancy test. But back in the heyday of the television in the 1950s, shows like I Love Lucy, the word pregnant could not even be uttered. Moral change takes place sometimes fast, sometimes slowly, sometimes measured just with a word such as this. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. There you'll find an article posted yesterday on the new shape of the debate between creation and evolution. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.